Welcome to Community Conversations. These are pre-recorded interviews brought to you each Tuesday and Thursday at 8 a.m. on KRFY. Because of ongoing concerns about the COVID pandemic, we are not able to be in the studio doing live broadcast interviews right now. But we are still dedicated to recording and bringing to you topics of local and current interest, highlighting voices from our community. For Community Conversations, we are using phones and web-based technology so that participants can be recorded remotely. Please bear with us if there are any gaps or hiccups that might be caused by a slow or unstable phone or internet connection. Also, keep in mind that because these interviews are recorded, information may change between the time of this recording and the time that you hear it broadcast. Thank you for joining us for today's Community Conversation on KRFY 88.5 FM, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. Good morning, and welcome to another edition of Community Conversations with your hosts on this Tuesday, myself, Phil Huff, and I'm joined again with my normal co-host, Julie Kellermine. Good morning, Julie.
Hi, Phil. How are you?
I'm good, but as we record this and the snow is falling outside and sure to still be on the ground Tuesday, I understand you're out chasing rainbows.
Rainbows of one form. I was chasing rainbow trout. I had to go to Eastern Washington to do that, though, Phil, because it's gotten a little cold and snowy here. But yes, I did, and it was a bit sunny over toward Moses Lake, so I'm glad we got out before all the snow fell here.
How late does that season go?
That's all the time, but it's not all the time easy to catch a trout in that little tiny creek because they are some educated trout, but we did have a nice time and at least we got some sunny weather. Well, happy good. To be back home though too.
I'm pushing snow off the driveway almost as we speak.
Yes, I know, and me too. I was shoveling just up until we started our Zoom interview for Community Conversations.
But the snowfall means something else, which at least in our area, in our region, when we get that first really solid shot of snow like this, it does kind of put a quell on the fire season.
Yes.
Which many people feel relieved about.
Yes, that's true. And that brings us into our topic for today's community conversation, which is about firefighting, wildland and firefighting, and some women's roles in that. And just to look at the broader topic for a moment, Phil, you and I talk about environment, recreation, the outdoors, and really there's no aspect of those topics that doesn't become threatened when the wildfires come, whether due to fire on the ground or air quality, all the changes we make when it's fire season. So as you know, we normally do at least one interview per year that talks about what's happening in fire. And this one came a little late because there were fires all around us, not too many near us. And the reason that we've selected this topic today, women and fireland fighting, is that I was noticing a really interesting article in National Geographic in August this year of 2020. And they were talking about wildland fires and also how they're managed and also how folks train for them. And in that article, I found the name of one of our guests this morning, who I'm about to introduce, and that is Deb Flowers. Hello, Deb.
Hello, how are you, Julie?
Yeah, great. I'm great. And it's so good that you can join us. And we're lucky you can join us because in this interim COVID period, we're able to interview folks that might be somewhat out of our region. Deb, you, even though you train outside of the state and train folks for wildland firefighting, you are located in Idaho. You're stationed out of Driggs. So at least you're somewhat in the state of Idaho. Yes. And our second guest today, that's right. And our second guest today is Megan Sailors. And Megan, you are a leader. You're the Hotshot Squad leader of the Redmond Hotshots. And that's in Oregon, correct?
That's correct. And thank you for having me here today. I appreciate it.
Yes, we're lucky to have you both. So I'll ask you both to tell us just a little bit about yourselves. Deb, why don't we start with you? Tell us a bit about how you got interested in this type of work, the work you do, and how you got to be in the job you're doing today. And then we'll ask the same of Megan.
Sure. So I sort of stumbled into fire, and right after school, I got a degree in environmental science, and I went to Florida on a job, a seasonal position with the Nature Conservancy, and they had a wildfire on one of their preserves, and I was hooked at that point. And so I got the training and started working seasonally for the Park Service in Utah on an engine, and then moved to Texas and Wyoming, and then here to Idaho, where I'm a zone fuels AFMO for the Caribou Targhee National Forest.
I want to explore just a little bit about each of your backgrounds a little more deeply. So sure. How did you get hooked? What was it? What was that attraction?
Well, I think it's, you know, fire is just sort of fascinating, you know, something that's natural like that, that's naturally occurring, you know, by lightning, and to see just the regrowth after a fire is just so neat. And the fact that you get to go places that I don't think a lot of people get to see is, you know, you get to see maybe different areas that the average person doesn't get to go or to experience.
Okay, and Megan, tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get involved in firefighting, and how did you come to be in the position you are now?
So I grew up in the shadow of the neon lights of Las Vegas. So trees weren't something that I grew up with unless they were literally in your front yard. So in my senior year of high school, I'm sitting in the front row because I was a super nerd. And it's like career day, and these folks are coming in and they're talking to our class, and three gentlemen come in, and two of them are in like their blue, really nice pressed, very clean uniforms. And then there's this third guy who's a little more rugged, a little less put together, and they were firefighters. There were two from our local structure department and one from the Park Service to come talk to us about these career opportunities. And the wildland guy, he's going off and he's talking about his job. And he's like, we hike really far, we go up really steep hills, and we eat terrible food called MREs, and we don't shower, and we work lots and lots of hours. And I'm sitting there going, no, I don't want to do that. Who wants to do that? That sounds horrible. And then we fast forward, and I'm in college, and I want a job during the summer. And I'm commuting to school because I didn't move away from home. So I'm commuting, and I wanted a summer job where I didn't spend the minimum wage I was getting to drive to work. So a good friend of mine, I was talking to him, I was like, oh, I need to find a job in our neighborhood, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, oh, my dad needs a secretary. His dad was the fire management officer for the National Recreation Area I live by. And so that's how I got reintroduced to fire. Doing that job, I was interacting with the firefighters, that gentleman who came to my senior class, but I got to interact with them differently. So I'm doing their time and some like stuff like that, but I'm hearing their stories, and I'm hearing the adventure and like the challenges and the camaraderie. And like I said, in high school, I was a super nerd. I was involved in everything. I had like, you know, my little school family, I had teams. And when I went to college and commuting, I didn't have that anymore. And so in working with them as their secretary, I got to see what I was missing in college. That little group of team and family was in this firefighting group. So that winter, I applied everywhere. And I mean everywhere. Nothing was off limits. If it was an application available, I put in for it. And by the skin of my teeth, I got a job there on an engine. And it just happened to be 2002. Which was the beginning of like the mega fires. And so we were super busy. And like Deb said, you get hooked.
You've brought up something I think that's very interesting. As with a number of professions where there's a high degree of danger, there's this real bonding that takes place, what's commonly referred to as a brotherhood. And I think we might say a sisterhood. But there is this sense that we're all in it together. And the people that I know who are firefighters or have family who are definitely have that sense of bonding. And you both have touched on that. Tell us a little bit more about that strength and that aspect of it.
Yeah, Deb.
Sure. I think, you know, you are experiencing the same thing together. And whether it's that long hike to get to an area that you have to put in a piece of line, or accomplishing putting in a piece of line that was miles long, and, you know, being able to, you know, just get something accomplished and knowing that you did it together, you know, there's nothing like it. And I guess just, it feels like you're, you know, you mentioned like that brotherhood or that sisterhood, but, you know, because you work long hours together and you're, you know, a lot of times you're work, you know, in the crew environment, you're there 24/7, you live together, you work together. And so they become your family. And so you tell them things that you would tell your family. And so you just build this really strong bond with those individuals. And I would say that you create these lifelong friendships with people just because of the experiences you had out on fires.
Yeah. And what's interesting for me is that, of course, you're both women, and we think of firefighting as more of a traditionally male occupation. And here you both are having come up in the ranks of firefighting. Talk to us a little bit about how that's been for you, both of you as women in a, for the most part, male occupation that really takes a lot of physical strength and, you know, physical abilities. So would you like to touch on that? Deb?
Sure. You know, it is, fire is a competitive job because you have to kind of work your way up the career ladder, and you have certain qualifications that you have to get to be able to move up. And so it's competitive. And then you have the fact that there are very few women, and it can be challenging because of that, because you don't have other women to relate to and to talk to if there's something specific and, you know, that, yeah, just that they can relate to you being a female in that environment. But I think it's, to me, it attracted me just because I like that physical aspect of it. I like the competitive nature of the job. And it was just something that I guess once I got introduced to it, there wasn't anything else I wanted to do. And, you know, because there is that, you know, there is an extreme physical side to it, and with the long hours and everything. And I think sometimes women aren't as attracted to it. I think that's just natural in this position. Although they said that, I think the numbers are like 10% of women have careers in fire management. So, you know, 90% are men. And so, yeah, finding your niche and feeling comfortable, it has its challenges.
Yeah. What about the history of women in firefighting? Would either of you like to touch on that? I mean, I think it's rather recent. It hasn't been going on forever, but are there any interesting pioneering women firefighters we might like to know about?
Well, I did a little looking because I wasn't quite sure either. And, you know, I'd heard first that, you know, they say the first female firefighters were, you know, they had the Forest Service Rangers. So when they were out, you know, with their husbands at their lookout towers, they were sort of the early firefighters, but of course they were unpaid. And so then you get into the 1940s, and I found that in California, they had their first all-women's crew in California. And then post-war, when we start looking at modern day, the first hotshot females were in late 1970s. So Sue Hasari, Kimberly Brandel were a couple. And then in 1981, there was the first female smoke jumper, and that was Deanne Shulman. So I think they were the ones breaking ground for us.
Okay. And Megan, oh, go ahead, Phil.
Yeah. I think if I'm remembering right, it was either in Steve Pine's book or it was in Timothy Egan's about the Big Burn, the Year of the Fire. One or both of them chronicle just that. Some of the wives of the backcountry firefighters who literally went out and were the camp cooks and were deep into the backcountry, days away from the nearest railhead when the burns erupted, and were integral to the fully functioning of those fire camps. While they might not have been out there with the tools on the line, they were certainly frontline workers.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, it was interesting reading up on that because, yeah, I think those are the ones that are the unsung women that were supporting in those early days in fighting fire.
Yeah, definitely. So there are a lot of places that people can work in firefighting, and you both work in training. Megan, you're in, I believe, if I'm understanding correctly, Megan, you're in active firefighting, and Deb, you're in training for the most part. Talk to us about where you all end up and sort of what the career progression looks like for both men or women in this profession. You go ahead, Deb, and then we'll ask Megan next.
Okay, sure. So there are many places that people can go for firefighting. You've got your engines, you have your hand crews, which I'll let Megan talk in depth about that. you have fire prevention, helicopters, so heli-tac crews and things like that. And so, my path, I went from an engine, and then I started working in the prescribed fire realm. And so I worked on a prescribed fire module, and I was burning on private lands. And so teaching people about prescribed fire, or private landowners about prescribed fire and how to burn. And then that was sort of my niche. I do suppression, and I have suppression qualifications and things like that. But prescribed fire was what was most attractive to me. And so the planning side of, fuels mitigation, of being able to put fire on the landscape, on the prescribed fire, active management from that area, that side of fire management is what I have mainly focused on in my career. And there are a lot of positions there for women in any of those areas.
Brings up a whole realm of topics we could talk about. We do want to focus in on the role of women in fire today, but I think one of the most interesting things that the public doesn't largely understand is that firefighting is about more than suppression, that sometimes it's the monitoring of those backcountry fires. And I think very clearly about a hike I took on the Continental Divide Trail in 2008, and the trail is literally the dividing line between Idaho and Montana. In the eastern part of the state, as you're aware, and the difference between not only two different national forests, but two different regions for the Forest Service. And we watched this fire as it was in little small pockets on the Idaho side. It was burning and doing some ecological good. And there's this fire hose line laid right along the trail, right along the divide for probably quarter mile, half mile, because the forests to the north in Montana had made the decision they were going to suppress any ember that came over. So literally you could look down from the divide, see two different strategies in effect, battling or containing or dealing with the same fire, which I thought was just fascinating.
Yeah, there are some differences in management, but I think, for most fires, when we talk about, we manage all fires. So whether that's for, just like you're saying, suppression objectives or their resource objectives associated with it. And so you had those two competing objectives, or I shouldn't say competing, but two objectives on two different forests. And it's, I think it's more complex than we think it is.
Yeah, and Megan, you're kind of tossed right into the middle of it from time to time. Tell us how your job works. I know that Deb is involved in training and prescribed burns, but you're kind of out in the midst of the hot fires, aren't you?
That's correct. Like Deb was alluding to, there's a lot of different opportunities in fire. And in a traditional job, we think of career advancement like a ladder. You start at the bottom rung and you eventually work your way up. But fire is a lot more like a jungle gym. And so you can go up, you can go down, you can go sideways, slide down the pole, whatever you want. There's opportunities everywhere, whether that's up and down an actual ladder or, across the country. And throughout my career, I've done a lot more on the operational side, was what we would refer to like the suppression type work, from working on engines and heli-tac crews to then eventually rappelling out of those helicopters. And working on what I'm currently doing now is I'm on an interagency hotshot crew. And the best way to understand how that they all fit together is basically we all fight fire. We just get to the fire differently. And then maybe once we get there, the tools we use might vary a little bit. We might call each other different names and tease and joke. But when it all comes down to it, all our efforts together are going and working towards the same objectives, whether it's the Idaho side who's letting the resources do some good with the fire, or if it's the Montana side and then we're like, we're going to put this out. And so mostly with the hand crews and hot shot crews is we're going to go into areas of the country that you can't necessarily drive to, right? These are the areas when you're driving down the highway, it's way in the background, up the steep hill, there's not many roads. We're going to drive as close as we can, and then we're going to get out, we're going to put on our packs, and we're going to hike our butts up that hill, and we're going to be out there. A shot crew, in comparison to a regular hand crew, tends to be higher qualified, so more experienced, more certifications, more self-sufficient than what's required of a regular crew. So we could go out and be out for days without having to be resupplied. A lot of times, because of the skill sets that are on the crew, we will get tasked with more complicated jobs on suppressing a fire or managing a fire, and that could be, you know, anything from putting in direct line along the fire's edge to pulling back and putting in a hand line that we're going to burn off later to give us a bigger area of non-vegetative space, so when the fire does meet it, that it doesn't cross over into an area we don't want to burn. But it's like a big family of 20 people. When we talk about like why people come and why people stay, it's a family. And just like a family, sometimes it doesn't matter if you're coming back at 30 years old to Thanksgiving, you're still sitting at the kid table. Fire's kind of like that. You get an opportunity to grow up, but not grow up at the same time. You're like, I'm literally playing in the mud for my job. So.
Something I've been thinking about too is there are many roles in our efforts to work with fire, manage fire, combat fire. In addition to the crews that are out there on the ground, there's a massive support logistics communications effort. I know a number of women here locally, some who work for the Forest Service or Idaho Department of Lands, who have gone out as the chief communications or public affairs officer on specific fires, and they are very busy. They have their arms absolutely completely full trying to communicate to the public, and frequently those very special communications with the small towns that might be surrounded by a fire, and you have a town hall meeting where all 200 people from the town hall come out and you're answering questions that are really important, and also for which there might be a limited amount of information. And those are some specialized skills too that I just want to bring up and mention, because I think some of our listeners include people who know the women I'm referring to, and they put in some long hours, really some arduous conditions as well.
Yes, and so that would bring us to talk, I think that would easily bring us back to talking with Deb about not just those coordination jobs, but the training that you do and that was highlighted in your National Geographic article. Deb, let's talk about what you do for prescribed fire, for the PFTC, the Prescribed Fire Training Center, and that's in Tallahassee. You make a trip out to do that, and that includes a lot of women.
Yes, so the Prescribed Fire Training Center is in Tallahassee, like you said, and their mission is they provide opportunities from the federal, state, local, and then other organizations to get experience and skills in prescribed fire and to enhance leadership skills with an emphasis on that field experience of prescribed fire. And so at PFTC, they have they have several women's modules. So the way PFTC is structured, so they have sessions through January through April, and they host what we call modules. So there's six-person modules with six students and then a seventh with the field coordinator. And PFTC we'll have three sessions a year that are these women's modules. And these modules are focused specifically, and you know, I think that's what's so unique about it is that we have modules that instead of having a mixed module of maybe, well, I shouldn't even say mixed, of a module of all men or a module of men with a couple women, these are only These are only made up of women. And the intent behind them is that we want to provide an opportunity for women to meet other women, because a lot of times when you talk to a lot of female firefighters, they're like, I don't have a female peer. I don't have anybody to talk to or to be my mentor or and so forth. So this provides that venue to have that mentor-mentee relationship, you know, to be in a place where they can build confidence and build those skills as a leader. Because, and Megan was referring to this, is, you know, in fire management, you work on certain qualifications. And as you do that, you know, you have varying levels of leadership, right? You start small, you've got a squad, and then in fire management, you move up and then you're in charge of, you know, division. So like a geographic area of a fire. And so that span of control and that leadership is growing as you go through your career. And so we want to provide those opportunities for women to feel comfortable in a male-dominated career. So having this ability to work in a situation where they feel more comfortable, that's what the Prescribed Fire Training Center does with these women modules.
What are the challenges for women, the unique challenges?
I can, I've been lucky enough and I've gotten to participate in Deb's program at the Prescribed Fire Training Center in Florida. And I think it's best to highlight the challenges by what it looks like when they're not there. So going through Deb's program and working with six other women is, one, not something at that point in my career I had had the opportunity to do. You know, there are moments in my career where I felt really lucky because I had two other women on the same crew as me, right? It's unbelievable. So
maybe 20 or something, like how big would the crew be? So
20 out of like my first year in fire, the station I worked at had engines and hand crews, and I was one female out of 30 employees, you know. And it's very often you can have one engine stations, which is like a crew of 5 to 7, and you're still the only female. And so going through a program like DEMS where everybody else is also identifying as female gives you an opportunity to be more authentic. I have found through my personal experience in working in different environments that right when in Rome, you tend to get along, try to get along and fit in without being too much not yourself. Being in that group of women and going through the training, you were able, or I personally felt able to acknowledge where I wasn't strong, what I didn't know. I felt more accepted in when I reached out to help others who didn't know something. It felt more collaborative. It felt more combined effort to grow together. And then there's the small things that you struggle with on a day-to-day. And one of the biggest, this is gonna sound really cheesy, one of the biggest game changers for me in work was literally like the type of underwear I wore. It just being very active, right? Like it's just not, someone just doesn't work. And it wasn't until I actually, the first time I worked with another female, she's like, well, I would just wear men's underwear. And totally cut, you know, all those problems I had went away. But working with a bunch of guys, they weren't gonna be, you know, they didn't have the perspective I did. And it was like just tiny, like, right, that seems like such a tiny thing. But my goodness, that has changed the way my uniform fits and like allows me to move. That's big, it's such a huge impact. And so providing that space for women to work with other women, those tiny things that we didn't realize were actually big barriers, go away. And that is what's so nice. And then when I leave that atmosphere where I've been able to grow and learn without the fear of social repercussions of being seen as weak or vulnerable, I go back to my home units, whether I'm on an engine or a hand crew, and I've got more confidence, I've got more skills, I've got more knowledge, and I feel stronger going in and taking and directing a group of individuals. And that's not something that's presented every day for me in my normal job without opportunities like the ones Deb's created.
Deb, that must make you feel pretty darn good to hear that.
It does. And, you know, I think that when we started these modules in 2017, I think, you know, the intent was that we wanted to help women stay in fire, and we didn't want them to leave. And I think, you know, to hear Megan and then to know that, I don't know, you're helping some people, I think at the same time it has helped me. It's helped me in the same that it's helped Megan and those other women, because it's an experience that I never got to have. So yeah, it's changed me as well.
So I'm wondering what you both see the future looking like, given that the training will help reduce some of the barriers, and then the actual experience produces role models for young women coming up who might be interested to actually see women in the field doing things, gives them the confidence or ability to see that, yes, it can be done. Someone like them is there doing it. How do we see the future going? Is this gradual, incremental, or are we at a point where there's a start, a period where we're about to take off and see greater participation?
Well, you know, I guess I think about a career, you know, and women being in this career. And I think, you know, it's a male dominated career, because I think that's, it just attacks, it attracts men. And, you know, there are things about it that I think are just less attractive for women in general. And so I don't think we're ever going to see a balance of like a 50-50 split. You know, I just don't think that's ever going to happen. But I think that the more we can have these opportunities to get women to feel more comfortable and feel accepted and feel like they can be heard, and to have people they can talk to help them be more successful, then I think that we'll see maybe more women stay in fire. And I think that was one of our key things with this program, is that we would see a lot of women at the entry level. So coming in those, you know, as a seasonal employee, which is, you know, you're paying your dues, that beginning part of it. But then as they moved along in their career, we just saw fewer women. And whether it was, you know, those things that, you know, the wanting to start a family, or, you know, personal pressures that maybe they're putting on themselves because of being the minority in a fire career and things like that, or maybe difficult peers or supervisors that they're trying to work with that don't support women in fire management. And I think there's a lot of things that go into it. And so I think there is, you know, I think we're getting to a place where I think we're going to see more women want to stay in fire management. At least that's really my hope, is that that's what we're going to see.
Yeah. You know, as our understanding of how we deal with fires changes, maybe as our country gets better at working toward not having so many wildfires, I could see a place where women would be a bigger part of that kind of a, more involved in that sort of a role in terms of fire. I don't know if you hear what I'm saying there, but you know, so much we're fighting emergency fires, but if we ever get to a point where it's more toward what you train for, Deb, in terms of prescribed burns and you know, preventing major wildfires, maybe at that point women would be more involved. I don't know if either of you have views on that idea.
Well, I think, and you know, Megan, I would say jump in here with your thoughts, but you know, it seems like a lot of, you know, operationally, I would say that on the operational side of fire management, that's where we see fewer women involved. It's on that, I want to say the fuels work and prevention and public information and those positions that can allow for a little more flexibility from that family standpoint is, I think, where we see women much more attracted to, because they can have a flexibility in their work schedule. And so I could see, just like you're saying, Julie, that yeah, there could be maybe more, you know, I would see more women attracted to that. You know, that planning side, because there might be a little more flexibility until you're going to, you know, your days of implementation of your prescribed fires, and then your days are just as long as suppression.
Yeah, Megan, what do you think?
It's kind of part of kind of a catch-22. Like Deb said, you look over onto prescribed fire, you look into fire prevention and dispatch and public information, you see a lot more women. So when you look in those roles as a female, someone who identifies as female, and sees another woman in a job, I can see myself. I can identify a little bit easier with that person initially. When I look in operations and I'm digging fire line and I look up and down the line, very rarely do I see another woman. Very rarely am I hearing another woman's voice on the radio. When I'm standing in morning briefing, you know, I'm one of maybe a handful of women when I go. And so being an entry-level firefighter and I'm looking at where I may fit in, just by looking, I'm not seeing myself reflected. I'm seeing myself on the other side. And overall, if we increase, you know, some of the ability to better balance our lives with our work, I think that that's better for everybody, right? Not just women, it'll be better for everyone. We lose men as they go on through their careers for very similar reasons. And as younger generations are coming up and have seemingly different values or importance on different values than maybe their parents did, that you see those changes coming in. And I think as we see those folks move up and their children and so on and so forth, you'll see a change within our wildland fire community that may be more welcoming, where women can see themselves in all positions, not just those.
I think that's a really good point. And as you touched on, the ability for women to occupy then those positions based on the restructuring of them for a better quality of life, that enhances the quality of life for their male counterparts as well. And I look at the workplace today, and certainly the generations that are coming up and starting their careers, this life balance thing is very, very important. And I think that will enhance the career paths in general, which I think leads into a really interesting question. What if somebody's listening to this and they're about to start their natural resource career and they think, hey, there might be something in this for me? How do they get started? Where would they go to begin a career in fire?
Well, I'd say, and we sort of mentioned it a couple times, is that you sort of have to first pay your dues. So you'll get what you look for is those seasonal positions. And typically, you know, for the federal government, we're looking at hiring this time of year. And so there are seasonal positions, and you can, USA Jobs, I would say, for the feds, is where you can find position seasonal hiring, things like that. But I think the thing to understand is that there's not just the fed, there's state, local, and non-government places that people can look to get experience and work towards getting a career in fire management.
And Deb, you mentioned that they're starting to do interviews now, and I think that's something that people don't realize necessarily, that you really have to get on it well ahead of the fire season. Yes.
Yes. And I think that's, you know, it used to be our hiring was in like February, and now it's our application period is October, November, December timeframes. And it varies by region. So you really have to be on top of it and really key in on those places you want to work. Take a look at where you can look online and start scouring for those jobs, because they're out there and you'll find them.
Mm-hmm. And what about places like municipal fire departments, like the city or urban fire departments? Does that give you a leg up if you're interested in wildland firefighting, or not really?
Yeah, you know, we'll have individuals that apply for positions that maybe volunteer at structure departments, or they have a job at a structure department that has a wildland fire component to it. And so sharing that in your application is definitely a positive and will benefit you.
Okay. And is there an advantage being a female applying, or is everybody just treated as an equal? Is there any advantage if you're a gal wanting to get into firefighting in any capacity? Or is it the opposite?
Well, You know, I would say that it's all, we look at all the applications equally across the board. But I know that, you know, if we can hire and there are women out there that are interested, and they're few and far between, but I would say they rate out equally and they're spread throughout the applications and the certificates equally. So they have a good chance.
There's a fitness component, I'm guessing. And do women in general, are women able to measure up if they're reasonably fit?
I think that physical fitness is a barrier we put up for ourselves. I know when I started FIRE, 7 pull-ups seemed like a miraculous goal that was never going to happen, you know? And lucky for me that those 7 pull-ups were required by hot shots and smoke jumpers and repellers. And when I started FIRE, I was not any of those. So the inability to do 7 at that time was okay. But it's doable. The physical stuff is doable. The most important thing to remember and what's really motivating is your physical fitness is an aspect of your safety, right? When everything hits the fan, it's your physical fitness you'll end up relying on to get out of that place. That's, you know, that's your last resort. Hopefully you don't get to that point because you're using your brain more than your physical fitness. But it's doable. Women can meet and hit the same standards. We have women who are smoke jumping. We have women who are on hotshot crews who are meeting not just our pack test, which is a requirement for all of our firefighters. This is a 3-mile hike, flat ground, in 45 minutes with a 45-pound pack. That's a minimum requirement. That seems like a lot. Like, I know when I first did it, 45 pounds was like over a third of my weight. Like, oh, doable. Doable. You just walk faster. But it's training. You can get there. It's a barrier we put on ourselves. That's achievable.
Very, very good point. It's a physical challenge, but ultimately a lot of physical challenges are how far we can push ourselves mentally. I think as we come close to the close of the show, I'd like to make sure there's room for either of you, both of you, to offer up anything we haven't asked, anything that comes to your mind as being of particular interest to our audience on the topic.
Yeah, Deb, go ahead.
Okay, well, I don't think I do, other than, you know, to folks that are looking at getting into fire management, and if anybody, and I would say, you know, gals, if you're interested, we got a job for you. So I appreciate the time with you all and being able to speak with you, and thank you for the offer to be here.
Thank you, Deb Flowers. And how about you, Megan? Any last comments that we might not have touched on that you'd like to add now?
No, I want to say thank you for allowing me the space to share about a job that has brought me a lot of joy. It's challenging and difficult for everybody. There are ups and downs for everybody. What those challenges are differ from person to person. And some of those challenges come from people not accepting everybody. But if we don't keep showing up, there won't be any doors to open anymore. So if you're interested, there's a place for everybody. There are so many opportunities and so many different aspects to fire management, natural resources. It's the doors wide open, just waiting for folks to come in.
Well, what a nice way to wrap up. I want to thank you both. Deb Flowers, USDA Zone Fuels Assistant Fire Management Officer out at our own Driggs, Idaho, and Megan Saylors, Redmond Hotshot Squad Leader. You've both been great, great women to hear from and understand about your experience in firefighting wildland fires. So thank you so much. This has been KRFY Community Conversations, our weekly show, and I just really want to thank you both for joining us. And we'll see you all next week.
Yes, thank you both.